Hello again, and welcome back to Musings on Sports. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with Bob Bupka. Yep, Musings on Sports, where great storytelling is our passion. And Bob, before we get to anything else, you, my friend, have what I think is a fantastic story having to do with a little gaming over the weekend, huh?
Well, you're right about that. You know, always fantasize about being the number one golfer in the world. The other fantasy that I always had, I'd love to be a whale, which is a big-time player, sitting at a blackjack table. But normally the whales are roped off behind closed doors and you don't get to see them in action. Last weekend, I took some relaxation time with Janice. We went to the Beau Rivage in Mississippi, one of my favorite watering holes, sitting at the blackjack table Saturday night. A rather nondescript gentleman comes and sits down alongside of me, has a little shoulder pouch on, Kel, reaches into the pouch, pulls out some bills, plunks them down on the table, and said he'd like some chips. Well, that pile that he plunked down was $100,000 in $100 bills. I've never seen $100,000.
And this was at a $25 table,
at
right?
At a $25 table. I mean, you would never see that. And unfortunately, he didn't have any success, I should say, with the cards, but seemed to take it very well. I estimate about 12 minutes that 100,000 was gone. I had less desire to be a whale after watching that.
Absolutely. That's all of it was gone in that period of time.
Gone in that period of time didn't seem to faze him a bit.
Yeah, what I think you had told me he had won a bet on a football game and maybe he felt like he had a little extra money to toss around. Is that what it was?
Yeah. Matter of fact, when he lost his last chip, everybody said, wow, too bad. He said, don't worry about it. He pulls out this sports ticket. He says, I have 100,000 bet on the Raiders and I'm winning that. So I'm going to go get that money right now. That's a whale, my friend. That is a whale.
That is a whale. And going to be a lot of money wagered on the World Series, which starts down your way. You and Janice are in Houston, you know, just down the road. The Astros, and man, are they on fire, having won all seven of their postseason games. And Bob, this is going to be their fourth World Series appearance since 2017. And they're taking on a Phillies team that I'm telling you right now is a absolute team of destiny. I don't know that they're going to win the World Series, but I saw the Washington Nationals pull off something very similar a few years ago when they, as a wild card team, had some good bounces go their way, some incredible pitching, a few hot hitters. And in this case, for the Phillies, Bryce Harper, Reese Hoskins are totally on fire. And what I find interesting is a lot of these series, you know, the opening game, you can say, well, if you lose one, it's okay, we can bounce back. I think game one of this series is huge because if the Phillies are able to beat the Astros in the first game, it gives them even more confidence. And now all of a sudden, the Astros, who have been flawless in the postseason, will have lost a game. I think game one Friday is massive. A buddy of mine works for the Phillies. How about this? They are flying every person who works full-time for the Phillies, about 400 of them and a guest, to Houston for the first two games of the series. That city is, it's already a mad, crazy sports town, but that city is way beyond ready to pull off a World Series upset.
It's going to be fascinating. The Phillies are exciting. And of course, the Astros seem to be so strong from top to bottom. I can't wait. Kind of sad in learning that every World Series game is going to start at 8 p.m. Eastern. And I always think that, you know, World Series, youngsters wanting to watch it on school nights and, you know, the 8 p.m. starting time. I know why they do it. It's for television. Oh, yeah. But I wish they would have at least one or two day games.
Well, Bob, yeah, you and I are both nostalgic about that. But we also both know the realities of big time sports. Hey, our guest today is a terrific guy, a great storyteller named Billy Kilmer. And when I was a kid, big time fan of the Washington Redskins in the 70s. Billy took the Skins to their first Super Bowl appearance. They ended up losing to the Dolphins in 72. That was the last time, by the way, you've had a perfect season in the NFL with the Dolphins that year, going 17-0. They won all 14 regular season games and then the three postseason games. And they just celebrated that 50th anniversary team. But having Billy on, and I think people are really going to enjoy him, Bob. Billy, you know, he actually played basketball for John Wooden at UCLA. He was known as much for his running as his passing, certainly in college and then throughout many of his years in the NFL.
Yeah, and he was a fascinating guest on Musings. I enjoyed it. I know our listeners are going to enjoy it even more.
Kind of segueing to football, if I'm a New York fan right now, it's really good, Bob. I mean, the Jets and the Giants are both on four-game winning streaks, and rightfully so. I mean, there's been no flukes with us. You've got a brand-new coach with the Giants in Brian Daboll. You've got a second-year coach with the Jets in Robert Saleh. And it's funny how sports works. The team, the players are buying into what these coaches are preaching. They're winning close games. They're starting to somewhat dominate with defense. And I think it's good for the National Football League, Bob, when you have your teams in New York playing well. In the case of the Jets and the Giants, it's been a while since they've both been off to the kind of starts that they have right now.
Yeah, and I'm sure the commissioner is very happy to have the Giants and Jets, you know, when they play well on NFL Sundays, the amount of viewership goes sky high. So good luck to the Jets and Giants, my old teams. We'll see what happens with them.
We don't talk a lot about hockey on this program, and we're going to talk more about it. As a matter of fact, the great announcer, Mike Doc Emmerich, is going to be a guest on Musings on Sports down the road a little bit. But tip of the hat, Bob, for goodness sakes, to Phil Kessel of the Vegas Golden Knights, who is now the Iron Man of the National Hockey League. 990th straight game he played last night as we record this on Wednesday, October 26th. That sets the all-time record. Bob, he hasn't missed a game in a very demanding physical sport as hockey. Hasn't missed a game since November of 2009.
Yeah, I mean, when I read that, I had to double check it. It just took my breath away. I mean, you know, hockey, you get a sprained ankle or whatever, you can't play. He's played 990 straight games. Good golly, Miss Molly.
And he's a hell of a player. He scored his 400th goal in that process. You don't last that long at that level if you're not a highly skilled player. And he's from a hockey family. His brothers, his sister, have played at the professional level. So hats off to Phil Kessel. Terrific player, played for a number of teams, and Kessel's what, maybe 36 years old. He's got a few more years left in him, Bob.
I don't know where that record's going to stop, but I'll say this much. That's a record that will never be broken.
I don't know if this is a record or not, but it's good to see Rory McIlroy getting back to the number one spot in the world golf rankings. I'm not sure how many times Rory's held that. He won the CJ Cup for the second consecutive year. This time it was played at a beautiful golf course in South Carolina. And it's, I suppose it's fitting in a lot of way, Bob, because he's become certainly the face of the PGA Tour through everything that has been a very chaotic year in golf with LIV Golf coming onto the scene. I think a lot of people are very happy to see Rory McIlroy back at the very top of his game and on top of the world rankings.
I think you're 100% correct. A little background information on the top spot. You know, it was created back in 1986. It has changed hands 91 times since then. But when I read these next three names, and tell you they never got to number one, you're going to be surprised. How about Phil Mickelson, Colin Montgomery, Sergio Garcia? None of which ever made it to the number one ranking. Greg Norman in second place, you know, he held it 331 weeks. But yeah. Tiger Woods, another record will never be broken. He was number one for 683 weeks. By comparison, Rory McIlroy, 107. So he's got a long way to go to catch up to the Tiger.
Yeah, he does. And, you know, we're going to be talking more golf down the road, certainly as things start to heat back up the first of the year. But I'm happy for him. He's a great guy. And and you've got a Ryder Cup year coming up, Bob. So in 2023, with the Ryder Cup to be played in the fall of 2023 outside of Rome, I know that it is massively important for Rory McIlroy to keep his guys winning on European soil. And the U.S., as well as they played about a year ago this time up in Wisconsin to win the Ryder Cup in what was nothing more than a rout, well, they're gonna have their hands full outside of Rome about a year from now.
Yeah, it's going to be very exciting. Rome is going over the top. Had some friends just visit recently with the 1 year to date of the Ryder Cup, and they said the entire city is behind it, even including the Pope passing along his good wishes. I mean, that is pretty amazing stuff. You know, Kel, before we go to Billy Kilmer, we got to mention about the news that just broke a day or two ago, in that our good friend Jim Nance has decided that he's going to hang up doing NCAA basketball. And we were fortunate. We had him on Musings on Sport, and we asked him how he felt about the NCAAs, and here's what he had to say.
It's just a ton of fun. It's a lot of preparation. It's a lot of getting to know teams that you might not be familiar with that have made it to the NCAA tournament. But the whole process is a joyride. You know, I think back to the championship game I really enjoyed most recently was in 2016 in Houston. And there was a shot at the buzzer that Villanova hit to take the title over North Carolina. And, you know, that was a thrill.
Yeah, Bob, and Jim was our very first guest on Musings on Sports back in March. And he's been doing this as the lead voice for the NCAA for Final Four and during the tournament since 91. He went to the University of Houston. The 2023 Final Four will be held in Houston. And he felt like that was a proper time for him to kind of step aside. He is going to continue with the trophy presentation for the foreseeable future starting in 2024, when Ian Eagle, who was a guest on our program not too long ago, will take over as the lead voice for CBS Sports. And we're delighted for him. And when we visited with Ian, he had some thoughts about the college game and calling those games.
When you're doing college basketball, the stories are really important for most of the athletes participating. This is the highest level they're ever going to play. This is a chance for them to make a name for themselves, and there's a chance for their families to hear those stories.
Yeah, I'm delighted for him. He was a Bob. By the way, you know, we've been very fortunate in the guests we've had, and both Jim and Ian, man, they're two of the best storytellers I've ever heard.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it, and that's why we call this show a home for people that love to hear stories.
No question. Everybody's going to enjoy hearing from Billy Kilmer, still going strong with great stories about his years at UCLA and in the NFL. And you will hear from Mr. Kilmer right after this from our good friends at Bridgestone Golf.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Bob, it's a particularly special treat for me to welcome our guest today. Sitting with my dear dad at RFK Stadium, I watched with delight as Old Whiskey himself led the Washington Redskins to their first Super Bowl appearance, and along with the great Sonny Jurgensen, was one half of the unique I Love Sonny and I Like Billy bumper stickers found all over the nation's capital in the 1970s. He's a member of the College Football Hall of Fame, and I believe, he'll let us know for sure, I believe he's the last NFL quarterback to have worn the single-bar face mask on his helmet. The one and only Billy Kilmer, welcome to Musings on Sports.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Was that true, what Kelly just said? You were the last to wear the single-bar face mask?
I wore it ever since I, you know, from UCLA to the, you know, my years in the NFL, I never changed. I tried to wear a one of those masks all over my face, you know, a wired mask like they have, and I couldn't see very well, so I said, get that thing off of me, and I just took the one bar. I was comfortable with it.
Oh, I was going to ask you, were those leather helmets comfortable?
Well, you know, it's funny. I wore a leather in junior college. We had one of those Notre Dame leather helmets back in, that was about 1957 or 8. Like.
Precious, precious.
And I had one bar there, too.
Go ahead, Kel.
Well, Billy, a lot to talk about from a football standpoint, but you played basketball for John Wooden at UCLA. I know you were an outstanding high school basketball player. Did you go to UCLA with the intention of playing both football and basketball?
No, not really. Coach Wooden recruited me when basketball was probably my best sport in high school, along with baseball. I played football because it was season, and I went out, you know, and I could play it pretty good, but, you know, basketball was my sport. You know, I made all CIF player of the year in my senior year, and Coach Wooden really, you know, recruited me pretty heavy, and he came to our high school banquet and spoke because of me, and I just knew professionally I wanted to be a professional athlete. I got offered $50,000 to play baseball out of high school, and that's where I really wanted to go. My mother put her foot down and said, he's going to college. I didn't raise him not to go. So my dad, you know, he saw the money signs. He wanted me to play baseball. But anyway, we ended up taking the football scholarship, and that's how I got to UCLA. But Coach Wooden, between my junior year, my sophomore and junior year, I was playing an intramural basketball game in the gym at UCLA, and we were in the finals. And a guy on the other team was Walt Hazard, was guarding me. And
sure.
Walt, you know, played for UCLA later on. He was in extension school trying to get eligible back then. And he played on the intramural basketball team and played against him. And I didn't know Coach Wooden was in the gym that night. And I scored 42 points over Walt. And we won the game and everything. So the next Monday or Tuesday, I'm down in the coach's offices, and the basketball coaches were at the under end, and I heard a voice said, Billy, come here, I want to see you. And I looked down the hall, and it was Coach Wooden. So I walked down there, and he said, you know, after the football season, it was 1959 football season, and he said, after the season's over, would you come out with the basketball team? And I said, sure, I'd love to, keep me in shape, and yeah, I'd do it. So that's how I got 1 year playing for him.
What was that like? What was that like playing for John Wooden?
Well, I'll tell you what, it was the thing about it. He was very structured. You know, you had to have your socks right and your workout clothes had to be, you know, just right. But when you got on that court, you moved all the time. He was really strong. Everything was planned, and you worked for an hour and 10 or 20 minutes, but you moved all the time, and you kept moving and to different drills and different things that would happen. And he was a really a no-nonsense guy, but he had certain rules, you know. He back then, a lot of guys had long hair. He wanted to have short cut hair, you know, and he had different rules. And if you didn't abide by them, he'd just say, okay, you're off the team. And most guys, you know, they went by him because he was genuine. He was like they said, the Wizard of Westwood, you know, and he was a great gentleman. I really appreciated him.
Well, Kelly mentioned about you being inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame, but your plaque lists you as a halfback and says you played tailback in UCLA's single wing formation. What position did you play, Billy? And please explain the single wing formation for those not familiar with that term.
Well, the old single wing was a running offense came out of Tennessee, and some colleges used it. In the 30s and 40s, that was the formation, was a single wing, you know, and the old Notre Dame box was the same thing. They called it different names, but it was basically a running formation. And the single wing tailback, and the reason I really liked it, and I got recruited to SC and everything, and everybody was playing the split T formation where the quarterback was an option quarterback on the run. He'd either run down the line or pitch it to the halfback or keep it and run. And you threw only two or three times a game. And it was boring. And I really didn't like football in high school. But when the UCLA and Red Sanders was the head coach, they came out to recruit me to be a tailback. And I don't know why, but they did, because we never ran it. And that always intrigued me. Back, I used to watch on TV all UCLA games, and Paul Cameron and Ronnie Knox and those, and I just loved the single wing. So I wanted to be a tailback. And when they came to recruit me, that's what I want to do. Now, when I got in school, because I could throw, they spread it out, and they called it a pro. It was a lot like the shotgun today. We ran. We could run, you know, our regular offense running plays off of it, but we split the wing back who was right up behind the tight end. We'd split him out, and we'd take our weak side in and split him out, and we could run a pro offense off of it, and we did a lot of throwing when I was at UCLA for 3 years. So, you know, we modified it because I could throw a lot better than the other tailbacks that they had recruited at the time.
Hey, Billy, most of the fans of my generation, at least, knew, you know, you having come to the Redskins from New Orleans, but you actually started your professional career in San Francisco. As you well know, as a rookie in 1961, you ran for more than 500 yards and 10 touchdowns out of what I presume was kind of the precursor to the shotgun formation. Is that right? At a time when in the NFL where 3 yards in a cloud of dust was more the norm, were you running the shotgun in San Francisco in the 60s?
Yeah, I got drafted by the Niners. The head coach at the time was Red Hickey, and he had, year before, he had put in a shotgun against Detroit. with John Brody and Y.E. Tittle running it, but they were mostly passing quarterbacks, you know, and he wanted the tailback to be able to run and pass too, to give a little more flexibility. So that's why they drafted me in '61. And my rookie year, they didn't start out with the shotgun right away. We worked on it in training camp, but then we played two games and we lost one to Green Bay. Then we went to Milwaukee and worked out a week, and we're going to play the Detroit Lions the next week. And that's when he put in the shotgun, you know, the offense. And he had three quarterbacks, me, Bobby Waters and John Brody, and we rotated. I would go in on first down. I ran 90% of the time. Bobby Waters would go in the next time and whatever the situation was. And then Brody was the third guy to go in. And John never ran. You know, he wasn't about to run. He threw all the time.
He was your traditional drop-back quarterback.
Exactly. And so, you know, we went to Detroit, and we spread it on them. They had never seen it before. We beat them, 49-0. And we had them running all over. I gained 100 yards and scored 2 touchdowns. The next week, we go home in Kezar and beat the Rams 35-0. I gain another 130 yards, something like that, and 2 touchdowns. And the fourth game, we go to Minnesota. And in Minnesota, I scored 4 touchdowns and gained over 100 and some yards. And so we went back to Milwaukee getting ready to play the Chicago Bears. And when Sports Illustrated came and did a layout on us, we're going to be the offense of the 60s was yeah. their theme. And we went to the Bears to play them. They beat us 31-0. Then we went to Pittsburgh, and it was a close game, but they beat us. They defensed us pretty good. Then we went back home to play Detroit one more time, and we kept the shotgun there. And they tied us in the game. I don't know what my stats were there. And the next week, the Bears came into town, and that was the end of the shotgun. I never saw it again. They went back to the tee.
Billy, was it basically the same shotgun that we know today in terms of where you were positioned behind the center?
Yeah, yes. Exactly the same. Now, we did a lot of running with halfbacks. We'd run a reverse with the halfbacks that were lined up next to it. It was a lot like it, but they spread out. You know, the bad thing is Red never let me. I threw 3 times off of that and completed 2 passes, but he never let me run the run pass option, which was my forte off the UCLA single wing that I ran. I could run that run pass option, and they never used it the way they should have. And so they got onto it and.
Right.
Rotating the quarterbacks, they could tell basically what we were going to run. So, it wasn't hard to defend against.
That's great stuff. There are certain moments in the history of the NFL that are indelible. Most are good, but in the case of something that happened in October of 64 in a game that you were playing against the Vikings, you caught a pass, you fumbled, and Jim Marshall recovered. He picked it up. Billy, tell us what happened from that point on, from your perspective, on one of the most remarkable plays, one of the most remarkable follies in the history of the league.
Well, my second year I came back, they switched me to running back. In 62, I had a good year until I broke my leg in the car accident. So when I came, I had to lay out all of 63, and I came back in 64. Jack Christensen was the head coach. And they kept me as a running back. So this Minnesota game was right in the kind of middle of the season and probably one of the last games I played as a running back. So I go out of the backfield. George Myra is the quarterback. I come out of the backfield, and he hits me with a swing pass, and I go across the middle. I get turned around. Carl Kosolke comes up and hits me right where I was carrying my right hand, and he hits me, and the ball bounces. Now, Jim Marshall is running full speed right at me, and right. The ball, instead of just rolling on the ground, it took a big hop right into his hands, and he never even broke stride. He just, boom, was going the wrong way, and it was about 70 yards. And he goes in, Bruce Bosley's chasing him. He's our center. And he was chasing him down, hoping that if he drops it in the end zone, he'll jump on it and we get a touchdown.
Yeah.
Well, the fans were going crazy. And And Marshall was so happy he scored a touchdown. Instead of dropping the ball, he throws it in the stands. So instead of us getting a touchdown, we only got 2 points. And we lost the game anyway. And that was probably the last time I ever played running back.
Yeah, that was an unbelievable moment.
Yeah, the stands went crazy.
Hey, Billy, back in 71, George Allen traded for you as he took over as head coach of Washington. Did you and Sonny Jurgensen get along right away? And how much fun did you two have, even though you were both trying to be the starting quarterback?
Well, look, when I got to the Redskins and I knew that I was the backup there, and I, you know, had no gumptions about that. And so we had one workout at Georgetown before the season started. George had called a squad in like in June or something before our training camp started. And back in those days, there was no, you know, camps like they have now. They don't work out all year long. But we came in June, and we got indoctrinated into a system. And so we're leaving Georgetown, and Sonny and I, we were coming out of the gym together, you know, we were kind of late. I don't know if we had a meeting or something, but anyway, I asked Sonny, I says, well, where do you go around here to have a beer? He says, well, jump in the car with me. And he took me over off of Wisconsin to a little bar that they used to go to all the time. So, and we've been together ever since. So, you know, we had a good time. But, you know, when I got there, I knew I was a backup to Sonny. And, when you get your chance to play, you know, you do. And he broke his shoulder in 71, in that one, the preseason game. And so I got to play, and we won our first 5 games. And, the whole town went crazy then, you know.
Hey, Billy, let me ask you, is it true that President Nixon actually asked George Allen to run a play in a playoff game in 1971?
Well, I don't know where that came from. George and him used to talk all the time. In fact, I've been in George's office and talked to President Nixon over the phone, you know, hello, and George would talk to him all the time. Whether he called the play, I don't know. But I know one thing. We're down on the goal line, and I called all the plays, you know, all the time. And all of a sudden, we're on the 6-yard line going in, and I forgot who the guy was, came in and said, the coach wants you to run a tight end reverse.
Yeah, right.
I said, where'd that come from? And nobody said it. I just thought to myself, because I wouldn't have called it. So we ran it, and we got stuffed. The defensive end at the time, he didn't go for all that, and he stuffed it on the 10-yard line. And that was in the first half, too. And we had a lead there. We would have made a bigger lead if we could have scored a touchdown there. You know, and then in the second half, they came back and won the game. But, I don't know where that play came from. But it, somehow somebody leaked it. It came from the president. Where it came from, I don't know.
Hey, Billy, you talked about calling your own plays, and that was the norm for a long, long time with quarterbacks. And it's obviously very different today. Did you, even in high school and in college, did you call your own plays, or did they help you at that level and then you started calling them in the NFL? How did that work?
Yeah, well, in high school, I called them my own plays. You know, it's funny, you mentioned that in college. Now, my first 2 years there at UCLA, I called all the plays, and then my senior year, they started running plays in. They'd rotate guards, I guess, at the time, and called all the plays. And I was kind of upset about it, because a couple of times I try to wave him off like I know what play to call on the goal line or something. He got mad because I'd wave him off. You know, he'd send in a play. So
you would wave the coach off.
I didn't like it because I felt that, you know, I'm in the game. I knew how to, you know, call a game. So.
Hey, Billy, we're beginning to wrap this up, and you've been fascinating to listen to. Was the drop kick ever executed while you were playing, or what do you know about the drop kick?
Drop kick? I'll tell you what. I tried to drop kick in high school, and it didn't go very well, and so I shelved that forever. So I'm not so sure about that drop kick. I did all the punting. One reason I wanted to be a single wing tailback. You did all the running, you did all the throwing, you did all the kicking. And I led the coast in punting in my senior year, and I was the total offense leader in the nation my senior year in college. And the single wing tailback was just fascinating to me, because I want to do. That's one reason I really went to UCLA, was to play the single wing. And I really, like I told you before, I wanted to play baseball. I got offered all that money. I had other scouts out there that were wanting to talk to me. And, you know, my mother kind of changed my whole life right then.
Yeah. Hey, Billy, what position did you play in baseball, and who offered you the money?
The Pittsburgh Pirates offered me that. That was the first guy in town that I was friends with was kind of a scout for them, and he brought in the scout. But there was other ones out there. But it was the Pirates, and I played all everything. I was a good hitter. I batted over 500 in high school, and I played shortstop. I love shortstop. I caught. I played. I played third base. I played center field. You know, I played everything. And, you know, my senior year, our team won what they call the CIF championship. We had a, you know, really good season. And in that final game, I went 5 for 5 and stole about 2 or 3 bases. And I love baseball.
It sounds like the Pirates were trying to steal you for $50,000. Billy, we're glad that we stole you. And I know our listeners of Musings on Sports are going to be deeply appreciative of the time you spent with us, giving us an education. And what a remarkable career. I know I'm going to let Kelly say goodbye, but thanks, Billy Kilmer. You are a remarkable athlete, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you, Bob.
Absolutely. Billy Kilmer, it's been a real treat. Thank you so much for your time and walking us down memory lane. And look forward to seeing you on the golf course here before too long, my friend.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Bob, one of the things that struck me about listening to Billy was that he played out of the shotgun formation in 1961, his rookie year with the Niners. That was a pretty progressive time for football, when 3 yards and a cloud of dust was much more the norm. But again, for me personally, I got to tell you what, to be able to have sat there with my dad at RFK Stadium and watched Billy lead the Redskins to an NFC championship win in 72 over the Cowboys, and then take the team to their first Super Bowl. A lot of great memories. And he, I thought he was a terrific guest.
Yeah, I thought he was fabulous. And I hope our listeners enjoyed Billy Kilmer. Just amazing that he also played for Coach Wooden at UCLA. That just goes to show you what kind of athlete Billy Kilmer really was.
Yeah, he really was a great athlete out of Southern California. And next week, we have a great voice coming out of the University of North Carolina and 30 years of calling world championship boxing for HBO. Jim Lampley is going to be with us. And folks, you're going to absolutely love hearing from Jim, who is not adverse to expounding on his feelings about sports. Fantastic storyteller. Bob, I can't wait for our listeners to hear him.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one. Can't wait. Make sure you tune in next week to Musings on Sports.